I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. It is the year 2059, and a constitutional crisis threatens a president of the United States. That's the premise of the new book, The Blue Folio. Its author, Matt McMahon, joins me now, and I'll get him to tell us about the sort of government America has. It seems in 2037, a second constitutional convention is convened, and the Constitution as we know it today is changed. It's an interesting premise, and the notices for the book have already been quite good. The author is lauded for his rich dialogue, and his depiction of a political scene is described as compelling and realistic. Matt McMahon is a trial attorney in New York City, something he's done for well over 30 years. He's a small plane pilot and a nature drone videographer who lives in New York and South Carolina. He joins me from New York today. The book is published by Black Ostrich Press. The website for more is at mattmcmahonbooks.com. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Matt McMahon. Mr. McMahon, good morning.
Good morning, Joseph. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for joining us. So tell us what happens as the book opens. It's 2059. Who's the president, and what seems to be the problem that she's going through?
In 2059, at the opening of the book, which is the prologue, the president is Beth Roche Suarez, who is, you get to know a little bit later on. The prologue is purposely a little bit short. But what she's doing at the very opening of the book is she's going to a signing ceremony for a bill. Actually, it's the SAFTA, which would be the South American Free Trade Act. One of the differences after 2037 is that it doesn't have to be an agreement. In other words, Congress can propose a treaty with other countries, not just the president. Mm-hmm. So everyone expects at that moment that this is a signing ceremony where she's going to sign this, because she has campaigned on this extensively throughout her campaigns, both when she was a senator and going for her first run for the presidency. And in the prologue, what we find is that instead of signing the bill, she vetoes it. And that raises a lot of ire, certainly by the congresswoman and the congressman and the senator who were present at the signing ceremony. They were the ones that proposed it. She's with her, in the prologue you get to know the main character as well. His name is Bill Waverly. Bill Waverly is her personal attorney. Mm-hmm. And you find out through the prologue and into the first chapter that he's really the one that brought her along. From She started out as a two-term mayor of Chicago, and then during a break that's required to be taken from politics because of term limits after 2037, she gets a job with a company that Bill Waverly was general counsel for, a company called Global Mundo, which is where she meets her future husband, Manuel Suarez, who... And Global Mundo is one of the largest companies in the world in the book. So that's where we start. That's where the stakes begin.
And so what, because as you say, there is a second constitutional convention in 2037, and you've already hinted at some of these changes to the Constitution that happens then. So tell us a bit more about that, and sort of what compels America at that point to change its system, to change, I mean, term limits is something that I guess there are term limits for the presidency, but I guess the term limits also for lower offices?
Actually, for all politicians.
Ah, I see.
Including senators, congress persons, state legislatures, judges, everything. But what starts the thing right now in America, and it's really been going on probably for about a decade, there's a growing discontent certainly with Congress. Recent polls, for instance, Gallup polls that were taken just before the most recent midterm elections, showed that only about 14% of Americans believe that Congress is doing a good job. And about 46% of Americans believe that the president is doing a good job. So when you hear on the news that President Obama is hated by most Americans, compared to Congress, he's loved because he has a 46% approval rating versus a 14%. And generally, if you go down and you look deeply into what is the cause of this discontent, it all comes down to one issue. And that's an issue that instead of the people being able to control not just what Congress does, but the business that Congress takes up, in other words, what it will vote on, that instead of that being defined by what the people want, it has become defined by what very wealthy individuals, corporations, and special interests want. Okay, for instance, recently there was a study that came out, I believe it was about 2 years ago, mm-hmm. or it may have even been earlier this year, by a researcher at Princeton University and a researcher at Northwestern University. And what they did is they went back over 20 years, during a 20-year period, and they examined every single government policy that was taking up in Congress. And what they found is that of all of those proposals, none of them had anything to do with what the people wanted, that it was totally governed by what the financial elite or the PAC funds, the lobbyists, what they had to fund. As a matter of fact, they came out with a fairly startling finding in the study that basically the United States is no longer a democracy because the people have virtually zero say in what goes on with the country. So that's what the current feeling is throughout a large part of America. And what makes it interesting is that that feeling or that belief that people no longer control what our government does isn't just on one side of the aisle. It's both conservative groups, it's liberal groups, as well as scholars, and also the people in the middle that all believe that. And there actually are calls right now for a second constitutional convention from many states, specifically to address Citizens United, which allowed the Supreme Court decision that allowed there to be unlimited funding by these financial elites. So that's the basis of what we start with.
Yeah. And so it is the America that we see in 2037, it seems like it's fundamentally different than the America of today, and it addresses, that Constitutional Convention addresses a lot of the concerns of today, and then if we take it to where the book starts in 2059, there's a great challenge to that consensus.
And the book flips back between 2037 and 2059.
Mm-hmm.
So what the book is tries to do is it tries to not just tell people what a second constitutional convention could be, but to show them what life would be like both leading up to this, a second constitution and what it would be like after a second constitution, how it would affect people in their everyday lives, politicians, and what would happen to those money interests that are no longer carrying so much weight in Congress. And that can lead to some unexpected consequences and some peril, which is where most of the book ends up going with it. But what leads to the actual call, because, again, right now, there have actually been, over history, almost 400 calls or petitions by states for a second constitution. Mm-hmm. Or a second constitutional convention. And in the history of the United States, there's never been one. The only constitutional convention has been the original one, which was in 1787.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, and the reason for 2037 is 2037 would be the 250th anniversary of the original constitutional convention. So in the book, what happens is a call for it starts around this time. Starting around 2015, there becomes a more populist movement calling for a second constitutional convention. But it calls for it not immediately, not right now, and not for specific issues. In other words, not saying we want a second constitutional convention to overturn Citizens United, which is what several of the states have petitioned for, or for a balanced budget, which some people argue that there are enough states requesting that there should be a second constitutional convention. Okay, but it takes a slow movement forward. And what the book does is it shows how the difference of the generation that is born starting in the year 2000 or slightly before it is different. the generations that preceded it.
Uh-huh.
One of the main reasons is that they rely more on social media, where if something's going on in the world, they don't get their information directly from mainstream media. What they do is they reach out to people who are in that instance or in that area and get the story straight from them. And so as a result of that, they develop a different attitude towards the way the United States government should be and how it should be responsive to them, as opposed to responsive just to the money interests. And then there's, I don't want to give it a spoiler, but there's an incident, a Supreme Court case in the book that takes place between 2019 and 2021, where the Supreme Court comes out with a decision that becomes very unpopular in a very human way,
mm-hmm.
Especially involving a certain child or young teenager. And that takes what a lot of scholars have said should happen and makes it more of a people type development, and
yeah.
So that they're the ones that then push it forward to the Constitution.
So the main character in the book is this fellow, Bill Waverly, who you've alluded to already. He, my understanding is, gets involved, but he has this friendship with George Comstock, a professor of his, I guess, who was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention of 2037. Is that correct?
Correct. He was, George Comstock was his professor at William & Mary Law School in Virginia. And he was a mentor to him, a father figure to him. So and George Comstock is in both periods. He's
mm-hmm.
both in the 2037 period, and he's in the 2059 period. And there's a few characters that are like that, but he certainly is a glue that holds us from one period to the other. And what he does is he goes to his professor to try to get his professor to help him in case the president... there's a possibility that the president could be facing a death penalty.
Mm.
And he wants to make sure that that doesn't happen. And George Comstock is his hedge on that.
So this for me, this will be fascinating, because I guess we'll get some insight into the drafting of a constitution in the course of this book and sort of the view of someone who was a delegate there. Is that right?
Correct. And because... probably a third of the chapters take place during the convention.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other main characters, which is during the convention, which is sort of the counterpart to George Comstock, is a delegate named Sebastian Irving, who is a sort of New York backroom politician type, who first starts out as a Democrat, then switches to Republican when it's to his advantage, and then joins what's called the Patriot Party, which is an official party split off from the Tea Party, so the ultra-conservative. And they have this rather tense battle throughout the convention that highlights the different way you look at how the business of government should be done. In other words, is the business of government making deals, or is the business of government doing what's right for the right reason? And so that's an obstacle that George and the other delegates have to overcome during the convention. And so the back and forth there is a bit tense at times.
Now, you easily, Matt, could have written, say, op-eds in the newspaper. You could have easily written a nonfiction book about the current political situation and how you see it progressing or degressing in some cases. So why fiction in this case? At once it seems like a better fit, I guess, for say looking ahead and presuming what could happen.
Well, I think, as I said before, the difference between fiction and nonfiction is the difference between showing and telling.
Mm.
And this is the type of an issue that most people, when they look at it, sort of their eyes glaze over a little, because it involves the Constitution, Article 5, a whole bunch of issues. And it starts to become very complex in the average person's mind pretty quickly. So by using it as a novel, what we could do is we could show them what it would be like, what would be in it for them, how it could change things, and also put a name on some of the things that they're so dissatisfied with now. Because a lot of people just have this attitude of, I'm not a big fan of the government, or I don't think the government is doing what we think they should be doing, as opposed to saying that if you look at what business Congress takes up, it has nothing to do with the people. As a matter of fact, Lawrence Lessig, who wrote Republic Lost, which in my opinion is probably the greatest book on this subject, he's a professor of constitutional law at Harvard. He gives an example in his book, which was in the year 2008, which that was when the economy crashed and we had a bailout AIG and we were the auto industry and talking about how places were too big to fail. Mm-hmm. And the point that he makes in the book is if you look at the business of Congress during 2012, the number one issue that they took up that year was how much banks can charge for ATM fees, which had nothing to do with the reality of the people of the United States. It had to do with the people who were funding PAC funds and who had lobbyists that could do anything to get access to. So this is a way of putting a face on it for them and helping them to see what's going on and what is a possible future for America in a very entertaining way. It's a pretty classic thriller in the sense that, like one reviewer had said, that it has everything you would want, the backstabbing, political antics, and it has all of that. Okay? And I think the characters are interesting to follow, especially Bill Waverly and Sebastian. They have journeys that they take that the reader has to take with them as to how they're going to act, how they're going to react to different things.
Yeah, and people today seem to be interested in sort of the drama that can happen in a political setting. I mean, you just look at shows like House of Cards,
sure.
The Newsroom scandal, even to a certain extent, Madam Secretary, the new one.
Homeland.
Yeah, exactly. So in terms of writing a novel, this is, I guess, the first time you've taken a stab at this. Is that right?
I've written other fiction works, and
I
wrote one other novel, but it's not something that we went crazy to publish with. It was more of a hobby then.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I'm curious to know, I mean, you're an attorney, but why write in your spare time, if you will? I mean, is this something that you always wanted to do, is it, like, even as a kid, or?
It's a little bit that I always wanted to do it. It's also the difference. It's nice release from what I do
mm-hmm.
As a trial lawyer. One of the differences as a trial lawyer, you're quite often faced with facts that to the average person might seem unbelievable because fact is stranger than fiction. And whereas fiction, you have the challenge of making it all seem, you can take fantastic facts and make them seem very real. Okay, so it's a nice release from it, and one actually helps the other. I actually had an editor that I worked with who I respect a great deal, and she had other authors, several of whom were attorneys. And one of the things, we were at a dinner one time, and one of the things everybody said almost at the same time is that writing fiction helped us be better at everything else we did. Okay, it helped us be clearer in whether it's trying a case or writing a letter or writing an op-ed or anything along those lines. It makes you look at how things are accepted by the reader so much better. It's a really good exercise. I highly recommend it for anyone.
Yeah, and so looking at where we are, I mean, in your country, and I guess it's the same in all English-speaking jurisdictions, now that I think about it, all jurisdictions where power is involved and politics and money. Do you see much hope for the United States? Is it going to get worse? I mean, it is pretty bleak now in terms of the influence that money has on your country's politics. I mean, does it get worse before it gets better?
I don't think it could get worse because based on the study by the Princeton and Northwestern scholars that looked at this, the American people have no say whatsoever over the business of our government. So it's not going to get worse. It's just going to stay the same until, again, some issue hits that's very human, that really hits people in the heart. I forget who it was that said that that compassion outweighs constitution. Okay, that the Constitution may have a great deal to say, but for people, it's about compassion in the United States. And so I think it is going to stay as bad as it is until people finally sit up and say, no, we have to do this. One of the things, too, over time, when you look back at when there have been calls for a second constitutional convention, when it gets close, and twice in history, three times in history, it's gotten very close. The most recent in 2013 with the balanced budget amendment, same thing in 1989, but also the 17th Amendment, which was for direct election of senators who previous to that had been appointed by state legislatures. Mm-hmm. Every time it's come close to where they thought the state was going to vote for a convention, Congress finally gets up and changes. So rather than let the states have a convention, which they tremendously fear, because it would take the power away from them, they will propose an amendment that is similar to what the people want. So even the discussion, even people saying we want a second constitutional convention, is likely to have the type of impact that Congress may not have a choice but to enact by itself, as opposed to having it as an overall convention. One of the things that I like with my book is that the convention takes place so far in the future. Mm-hmm. Because one of the dangers of a reactionary convention, when people say we need a balanced budget, they're reacting to maybe a particular president or a particular Congress. And the danger is you don't want to say, okay, let's rethink everything because we don't like this.
Yeah.
If you give people 22 years to think about this, or 20 years to think about this, to discuss it, you know, we get an educated population again. We get a people who can go on to websites and join various groups to discuss this. Everybody can throw out proposals over 20 years that by the time the convention comes, it's not a reactionary thing. It's what the country really needs.
Yeah. Well, from what I've read of the book thus far, and it's I haven't barely cracked the spine, if you will. It's compelling stuff, and it's a book that I know that I'm going to enjoy reading. I can't wait to read it. Matt, continued good luck with the book.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Justin.
The website for more, mattmcmahonbooks.com. The book is called The Blue Folio. It's from Black Ostrich Press. Its author, Matthew McMahon, joined me on the line from New York and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.